This is Audible.
Penguin Random House Audio presents The Address by Fiona Davis. Read for you by Saskia Marleveld and Brittany Presley. Chapter 1. London, June 1884. The sight of a child teetering on the window ledge of room 510 turned Sarah's world upside down. After several years toiling as a maid and working her way up the ranks, she'd been awarded the position of head housekeeper at London's Langham Hotel a month prior. One of her largest tasks was keeping the maids in line, all young girls with hardly a shred of common sense among them. When they should have been straightening the rooms, she'd more often than not find them giggling in the hallways or flirting with the boys delivering tea trays or flowers. That morning, she'd been called into the manager's office and reprimanded for not being harsh enough on her charges.
"You're soft. We're starting to wonder if you're simply too young for the position," said Mr. Birmingham from behind his walnut desk, which, despite its elegant spindle legs, was roughly the size of a small boat. Having recently turned 30, Sarah didn't feel young in the least. Not that she'd ever acted that way. When she'd first arrived at the Langham, she'd skipped the giddy overtures of friendship from other maids her age, knowing that she had to stand out if she wanted to move up quickly. Her coolness had paid off, and her higher salary more than made up for the lack of companionship. But for Mr. Birmingham, who found pleasure in making the younger maids cry, Sarah's self-imposed isolation wasn't enough. He directed her to take a seat, but once she had settled herself, the perspective in the room suddenly felt off, as if something in the furniture's configuration had changed since Mr. Birmingham last summoned her to this spot. Or else she was so annoyed by his request for an interview during the busiest hours of the day that she'd worked herself into a kind of nervous imbalance. Sarah's employer was short and had the poor luck to have a torso shaped like a chicken egg with a double yolk. She towered over the man by several inches, yet somehow Mr. Birmingham was peering down at her from his throne-like seat. She stole a glance at the floor. The bottom 5 inches of his chair's legs were stained a different color than the rest. He'd had them lengthened. When she looked back up, he puffed up like a songbird, clearly peeved that she'd noticed. She shifted in her seat. "I'm sorry, Mr. Birmingham. I will be tougher on the girls." "If they're difficult, give them a slap. Better yet, send them down here and I'll do it for you."
He licked his lips. Right. She imagined he'd enjoy it immensely. "Is there anything more?"
No, Mrs. Smythe. Off you go."
She was still getting used to being called Mrs. Strange how a single promotion afforded not only a living wage, but also a new moniker that had nothing to do with her marital status, or lack thereof. No head housekeeper could be called a miss. Wasn't proper. The girls were still getting used to addressing her by her full name, and she had to be firmer with that as well. It wouldn't do for Mr. Birmingham to overhear them calling her Sarah. It might be the last straw on what was a very unstable haystack. That hot June afternoon, after patrolling the halls and basement to break up any assignations, she retreated to her office on the 6th floor to double-check the laundry bills. She needed a rest from shooting dour looks at the girls. Her face was tired from scowling. The one window in the room was open as wide as possible, in order to catch some semblance of a breeze. But the weather refused to cooperate. All day the air had been still and humid, making the hotel feel, and smell, a little like the greenhouses at Kew Gardens. A movement from the curtain drew her up from her desk, in the hope that an afternoon thunderstorm was brewing. To her disappointment, the sky was a hazy blue. She looked across the courtyard, and there, one floor below, a flash of flesh caught her eye, a chubby arm with fingers that grasped the edge of the sill. Then another arm flailed out and did the same, followed by a head covered in golden curls. The girl sported a velvet bow on the back of her head at a skewed angle. Sarah's breath caught in her chest. Surely a minder would appear at any moment and guide the child back into the room. With some effort, the child eased her chest up onto the windowsill and stayed motionless for a second, surveying the ground below, arms dangling downward. Sarah willed the child away from danger. If she called out, there was a chance she would frighten the child into pitching farther forward. But still no one came. To her horror, a foot swung up and over the sill, three limbs in all. The child was climbing up, possibly drawn to the cooler air and away from the stifling room. There was no time to waste. Sarah sprang out of her office and down the corridor, one hand clutching the heavy chatelaine of keys that dangled from her waist. She lifted her skirts far higher than was decent and dashed down the stairs, her eyes riveted on the few feet in front of her so she wouldn't lose her footing on the slippery marble. At the fifth floor, a couple of guests stepped off the lift and she swooped by them, muttering a quick apology, without losing a beat. Then a turn left, and what seemed like an eternal race to the door of room 510. No banging, it might startle the child, and at this point it didn't matter if she was barging in on anyone, even if doing so was against hotel policy. The key turned smoothly in the lock, and she opened the door. The girl, wearing a peach-colored dress, now stood upright on the sill facing out, one hand clutching the casing. She had to be around 3 years old. What was she doing alone? Walter, one of the porters, and Mabel, the floor's chambermaid, appeared by Sarah's side, breathing heavily. They must have sprinted after her, knowing something was terribly wrong. Sarah put out her arms to stop Mabel and Walter from moving any farther into the room. "Shh, we don't want to send her off balance."
"Where's a minder?" whispered Mabel. "Is anyone in the bedchamber?"
"I don't know." Sarah took a step into the room, walking as if the floor might give out at any point. The plush rug softened her footfall. As she grew closer, she realized the child was singing to herself, a lullaby about being on a treetop. The child turned her head and stared at Sarah. Her rosy lips parted, and her eyes grew round. Sarah held out one hand, palm up, and began humming the same tune softly. In response, the child laughed, but then, with the changeability of her age, her eyes suddenly filled with tears.
"Mama!"
the girl demanded, then shook her head. Sarah didn't dare move any farther, and her muscles tensed with the effort of doing nothing, staying frozen. A breeze blew in and ruffled the girl's curls, pushing her slightly off balance. If she fell backward, into the room, Sarah might be able to reach her in time to break her fall. But instead, the little girl overcorrected, and her hand began slipping off the window frame. Such tiny fingernails, tiny fingers. Sarah lunged forward. Her hand grazed the voluminous skirt of the child's dress, and she gripped as much of the material as she could, yanking hard. The girl, shrieking, flew off the ledge, inside, to safety. They hit the ground together in an awkward tangle of limbs and petticoats, the girl practically sitting on Sarah's lap. The girl twisted around and looked at Sarah, blinking in astonishment. Sarah was sure she'd cry out, but instead the girl resumed her babbling song while reaching up with one hand to stroke Sarah's chin.
"Well done, just in time," said Walter, as he and Mabel gathered on either side of her.
"Do you think she hurt herself?" asked Sarah.
"No, not a whit. You broke the fall. Are you all right?"
Mabel scooped up the child, while Sarah let Walter help her to her feet. She was straightening her skirts and rubbing her hip, which no doubt would sport a large bruise by tomorrow, when a tall, thin woman appeared in the doorway.
"What on earth is going on in here?"
the woman demanded, clutching the hand of a little girl a few years older than the one held by Mabel. The name popped into Sarah's head from the guest book. The Honorable Mrs. Theodore Camden, traveling with 3 children, a husband, and a small coterie of servants. Mr. Birmingham had instructed Sarah that all of the Camdens' needs be anticipated, as the wife was the daughter of a baron. Sarah stepped forward.
"The child was standing in the window, and we brought her inside."
"More like saved her life," said Walter. "Mrs. Smythe here leaped in and dragged her back inside in just the nick of time."
The child, as if realizing the heightened emotions of the grown-ups around her, began to wail. The woman dashed forward and scooped her out of Mabel's arms, holding the girl close. When her cries subsided, Mrs. Camden looked up, as if seeing them all for the first time.
"I thank you for your assistance, but where is her nanny?"
As if on cue, a plain-looking girl stepped into the room.
"Ma'am?"
she inquired, her face scrunched up in confusion.
"Miss Morgan, where have you been? Lula almost fell to her death due to your absence."
"I'm sorry?"
The girl gazed around at everyone in the room.
"I popped out for only a minute to drop off a postcard at the front desk. I thought Mr. Camden was here."
Her voice trailed off and she looked about, as if trying to summon him out of thin air.
"You were supposed to be here minding the children."
The child buried her head in her mother's shoulder, weeping again.
"Where is Luther?"
Mrs. Camden rushed into the adjoining room and they all followed. Another child, a boy who seemed to be around the same age as Lula, lay on the enormous bed, fast asleep, his curls damp around his head. Sarah, standing beside Mrs. Camden, could practically feel the woman's fear and relief emanating from her body, like aftershocks of an earthquake. The nanny took Lula from her arms and set about calming the girl down, avoiding her employer's eyes. How awful if something had happened. 2 little children left alone with a wide-open window. The thought was unimaginable. Sarah turned to Mrs. Camden. The woman's profile was precise, her coloring fair, other than thick black lashes that framed hazel eyes. Sarah had encountered innumerable members of the peerage at the Langham, and they all shared a common way of moving in the world, a confidence that their every desire would be met. It was rare to see one in crisis. She sensed Walter and Mabel hovering behind them and became protective of the woman's dignity.
"Is there anything else we can do, Mrs. Camden?" asked Sarah.
"No, that is all."
The woman's face softened.
"Thank you for saving her."
"Of course, Mom."
Sarah nodded to Walter and Mabel and led the way out of the room. Once the door was closed behind them, Sarah exhaled with relief.
"Oh, that was a close call."
Walter rubbed his forehead with the back of his hand.
"You were spectacular, Sarah. Mrs. Smythe," said Mabel.
Sarah wanted more than anything to crumple onto the floor, but she couldn't allow her staff to see that.
"That's more than enough excitement for one day. Back to work. And Mabel, please remember to address me properly."
"Of course, Mrs. Smythe."
Sarah turned away and strode down the hallway, grateful her quaking knees were hidden under multiple layers of petticoats and skirts. The rest of the day, whenever Sarah's mind returned to the events in room 510, her heart thumped wildly in her ribcage. What if she hadn't grabbed the child in time? What if she'd had to peer over the edge and see the lifeless body splayed on the hard ground of the courtyard below? Sleep tonight in the damp heat of her Bayswater bedsit, would be impossible. But there was enough to keep her busy until then. She finished updating the ledgers and was about to head out to inspect the turndown of the guests' rooms when a man rapped on her office door. She knew it was a man from its hard, hollow sound. Maid's knuckles were barely audible, already apologizing for disturbing her. But the men, whether Mr. Birmingham or the janitor, had no such qualms. She stood and opened the door, expecting Mr. Birmingham to have made a special trip upstairs to upbraid her for causing a scene with the guests. Instead, a stranger's face peered down at her. As if he sensed her discomfort, he stepped back a pace.
Mrs. Smythe?
Yes. May I help you, sir? He was clearly a hotel guest, dressed in a fitted, bespoke suit with a Broadway silk hat tucked under one arm.
I apologize for intruding.
He wiped his brow with an enormous hand.
How do you manage up here with this insufferable heat?
It's a rare occurrence, luckily.
I believe you saved my daughter Lula today. I wanted to thank you in person. My name is Mr. Theodore Camden.
His accent was American, his voice a warm tenor. Sarah gestured to a chair opposite her desk, offering him a seat. He moved with an unexpected grace, given his large build. Nothing about him was handsome, by standard measures. His head was small in contrast to his broad shoulders, his eyes close-set to an irregular nose. But when put all together, he was magnetic. She sat, looked down, and closed the ledger in order to stop herself from staring. I'm glad she's safe. She's all right, isn't she? The image of the wailing girl came to mind.
Yes. We offered her a slice of Battenberg cake, and she's completely forgotten the incident.
He chuckled before a brief look of pain crossed his face.
I don't know what would have happened if you hadn't gotten there in time. The twins, Lula and Luther, are constantly getting into trouble.
Best not to think of it. Sarah was unsure how to proceed. She'd never had a hotel guest in her small office, and he was so tall he took up much of the space.
How did you know what was happening?
Mr. Camden leaned back in his chair, his hat in his lap. He didn't seem to realize how indecorous it was to be sitting together like this, even if the door was open, so nothing could be construed as irregular. It was almost as if he enjoyed it, while most guests wouldn't dream of mingling with the staff. I can see your hotel room from my window. I stood to get some air, and saw her climb up.
The girl was supposed to be watching the twins while Mrs. Camden was out. Needless to say, she was fired immediately.
Well, luckily all turned out well. Other than for the nanny, of course.
What is the ratio of staff to guests here?
Such an odd question. We have 300 rooms, and a staff of approximately 400.
How long have you been head housekeeper?
This is my first month. He hadn't come up here just to say thank you, she was sure. Something else was driving his line of inquiry. She squared her shoulders and leaned slightly forward, as if into a wind, curious to figure him out. But I've been working here in some capacity for the past 11 years.
You know the place well.
I do.
Mr. Birmingham says you are highly efficient.
Mr. Camden had inquired after her. That's kind of him to say.
It's a grand building, the Langham. Beautifully built.
Yes. Americans were very strange indeed. He didn't seem to be in any rush to get back to his family. What if Mr. Birmingham had sent him up here as some kind of a test? I'm happy to be employed here.
This hotel featured the first hydraulic lifts in England. Did you know that?
Perhaps he was the type of man who collected facts and loved to show off how much he knew. She nodded. Mr. Camden smiled.
I'm going on and on, sorry about that. I simply want to figure out a way to thank you.
There is no need. The hotel staff does everything it can for its guests.
You did more than that. I hope you didn't injure yourself in the process.
Not at all. One of the laundry girls popped her head into the room and then jumped back, startled when she caught sight of Mr. Camden.
Sorry, Mrs. Smythe. I'll come back later.
That's fine, Edwina.
Edwina, my mother's name.
Mr. Camden swiveled around and gave the girl a smile. His face beamed with delight.
Edwina, may we trouble you for some tea?
He was here to stay, but what for, she couldn't guess. Edwina turned to Sarah. Her eyes held the same faint alarm Sarah's must have, but Sarah checked herself.
Yes, please, Edwina.
The girl shuffled off, and Mr. Camden turned back to Sarah.
If I'm not keeping you from anything, of course.
Not at all. But there is no need for further mention of the incident. All's well, as they say.
May I ask about your background?
I'm not sure if that's necessary, Mr. Camden. He blushed. She hadn't meant to embarrass him, just wanted to redirect the conversation. But how easily he'd gone all pink, like a schoolboy. Caught off guard, he tilted his head and stammered.
In a professional capacity, of course. I'm quite interested in how a big place like this keeps running along day after day, crisis after crisis.
I assure you, we seldom have crises like the one today. Most of the time, it's a well-oiled machine. One of Mr. Birmingham's favorite expressions. She'd never liked it, as it turned the flesh and blood staff into cogs in an engine. But she was uncertain how to keep the conversation with Mr. Camden flowing.
Of course not. What would you say is the biggest problem the staff encounters?
She considered the question. We are a first-class hotel, Mr. Camden. We make sure that every guest's whim is answered. Sometimes that can be a juggling act, as the turnover is quite high.
Do many of the guests bring their own servants?
Of course. But they still need rooms cleaned and freshened. Ladies' maids and butlers have their own roles to play, separate from the hotel's amenities.
Before this, did you work in service?
I did not. However, my mother was housekeeper to an earl. Before this, I was a dressmaker's apprentice.
Yet you still ended up in service.
She should never have offered so much of her own history. But something about the man's manner made her speak more than was proper. And now she'd stumbled into uncomfortable territory. The tea arrived, and Sarah welcomed the interruption. Enough with Mr. Camden's incessant questions. She would turn the tables, regain the upper hand. As she poured the tea, she inquired after his work. Americans seemed to enjoy chattering on at great length about their accomplishments. He rose to the occasion.
I'm assisting the construction of an apartment house in New York City.
You're an architect? He beamed.
Yes. I work for the great Henry Hardenberg.
Sarah shook her head. I'm afraid I'm not acquainted with his name.
He's taking New York City by storm. He's designed a place where the best families can live with elegance and privacy, sharing amenities like laundry and housekeeping. Why, we're even keeping a tailor and baker on staff. As you can see, I'm fascinated with the inner workings of places like the Langham. Who keeps it humming and how?
That explained everything. Her shoulders dropped and she offered a warm smile, relieved that Mr. Birmingham wasn't behind the interrogation. It sounds like a large project.
The Dakota, it's called, and it will change the way the upper class of the city live. At the moment, the elite of New York reside in brownstones, equivalent to your terrace houses, with one family per abode. The idea of sharing common space and amenities with others, as the French do, is considered gauche.
And why is that?
It's too similar to a working-class tenement, where dozens of families live together in poverty and squalor.
He continued on about the new building, barely stopping for breath. And she drank down her tea quickly, grateful for the liquid on her parched throat. Finally, he pulled out his watch.
I must go. We leave very soon, heading back to New York. I say, you wouldn't want to work at the Dakota, would you?
Her cup clattered against the saucer. She'd looked up when he'd spoken and missed the center. He laughed.
I see I caught you unawares. We're in need of a head housekeeper, and you are obviously well qualified. New York City is an exciting place, I promise. I could mention your name to Mr. Douglas, the building's agent.
His words came tumbling out, as if he'd only just thought of the idea. Perhaps he had. Typical American boldness. It was a ridiculous suggestion, going to another country when she had a perfectly good job here, even if Mr. Birmingham was never pleased. I'm quite happy where I am, Mr. Camden, but thank you for the offer.
I'm serious.
His voice and visage grew animated as he worked through the details.
I'm going to send you a formal letter when I get back, as well as fare to come over. The opening is set for the end of October. Consider the idea. It's the least I can do after what you did for my family today. Will you consider it?
She shook her head. He was caught up in the moment, an impulsive American like many others she'd encountered at the Langham. Too loud, too close, no sense of propriety. No, Mr. Camden, but thank you. Please let me know if there's anything else you need during your stay. Good day. After he'd left, she shut the door behind him and went to the window. The one to room 510 was firmly shut, curtains drawn. Good. She'd had more than enough excitement for one day. Chapter 2. Fishbourne, August, 1884.
I really don't know why you bothered to come. I'm perfectly fine.
Sarah's mother pulled the wool blanket around herself with trembling hands, and Sarah stifled the impulse to jump up and arrange it around the woman's sloping shoulders. Doing so would only cause further aggravation. She took a sip from her sherry glass.
I come this time every year. Remember? My holiday from the hotel. Of course I remember. I'm not losing my faculties, Sarah.
Her blue eyes settled on her daughter, lips turned down in a perpetual frown.
I just don't see what the point is. You might as well stay in London and work your fingers to the bone, since that's what you enjoy doing. I have every mind to speak to his lordship about this.
They were gathered around the fire at the cottage in Fishbourne, where her mother had settled years ago, after leaving her position at the estate of the Earl of Chichester, 40 miles to the east. Even during the long evenings of August, the house stayed as chilly as a November morning, as if the walls, like her mother, repelled any warmth from the outside. Sarah attempted to guide her back to the present day.
You no longer work for his lordship, remember? It's been 30 years.
The number was an easy one to remember. Her mother shook her head.
No, I don't think so.
Her words seemed far away, as if she were speaking down a long tunnel.
Now I'm head housekeeper at the Langham, just as you were at Stanmer House. Why'd you want to take after your mother when I gave you every chance of bettering yourself is beyond me?
She waved a hand.
Pour me more sherry.
Even before her mind grew soft, her mother had commanded Sarah and her charwoman, who was paid with a good portion of Sarah's wages, without a please or thank you. Perhaps she lived a different life in her imagination, one where his lordship made her his countess after getting her with child, instead of the reality, where she toiled day in and day out, until her shaking made even holding a teacup untenable. After refilling the glass, Sarah held it to her mother's lips, then sat on the settee and picked up a ragged petticoat that needed mending. She could feel her mother's eyes on her fingers as she deftly fixed the rip at the seam.
Your stitches are better than mine.
A compliment. Sarah kept her eyes down, knowing that she could easily ruin the moment.
Thank you, Mum. I still don't know why you left Mrs. Ainsworth to go to London. Your hands could have made a fortune.
It wasn't a good fit.
You tossed over an opportunity, if you ask me. Mrs. Ainsworth's husband died 3 months ago. Did I tell you that? Got run over by a carriage.
Probably driven by one of the women who'd apprenticed with his wife. Sarah would have run him over herself, given the chance.
London suits me. The Langham is a first-class hotel, as big as Stanmer House, but so many more people come through every day.
But are they the right sort of people?
They ought to be, if they can afford 15 shillings a night for a room.
They had this conversation every year, and Sarah couldn't help but defend her decision.
You work in a hotel. Fancy or not, it's no place for a good girl. Money's no sign of good breeding.
Nor is good breeding an indication of morality. Her mother gave a sharp intake of breath. Sarah looked up, an apology on the edge of her lips. But her mother spoke quickly.
You don't know a thing about it.
Of course, Mum.
To change the subject, she blurted out the next thing that came to mind.
I've been given a new opportunity.
She'd put off mentioning the letter she'd received from Mr. Camden since arriving at her mother's, knowing it might increase her contempt. But now she had something to prove.
Eh? What's that?
To work as a head housekeeper at a grand apartment house in New York City.
There. She'd said it. Her mother's face curdled.
In the States?
Yes. You see, the child of a guest almost fell out a window, and I happened to see her and save her, and the father was so appreciative, he offered me this position.
Her mother remained silent for a moment. Sarah tied a knot in the thread and folded up the petticoat, smoothing the dingy material on her lap. She would give it a good wash tomorrow. She had to admit that she'd been shocked to receive the letter formally asking her to come abroad, and a ticket for a second-class passage on a ship from Liverpool, as well as a check to cover her expenses. Mr. Camden had asked her to consider the offer, and if she decided not to take it, to send the monies and ticket back. She found the fact that he'd trusted her to do so quite unusual, as their acquaintance had been so brief.
The child fell out of the window.
Almost, but I got there just in time. To be honest, I'm not sure what I should do.
If you go to America, I will never see you again.
The delivery was a statement of fact, the only sign of worry a slight waver in the last word.
The passage takes only a week. I can come back to visit.
How soon do they want you there?
The apartment house is due to be finished by the end of October, and they'd want me to arrive a month before to get everything in order.
You can't seem to stay with one thing, can you? Always taking risks and changing your mind.
Mother, I've been working at the Langham for 11 years. I would think my constancy is not in question.
It's more money, much more, which means we can afford to buy you a new petticoat and have Avril to take care of you. Not choose one over the other.
Avril's a silly nit. And what do I need money for? I'm soon to die.
You're not soon to die.
That's not what Dr. Torrington says.
He told me you're doing beautifully.
Her mother turned her head away and shut her eyes, and the subject was closed. Later that evening, after her mother had been helped to bed, and Sarah could hear her snores through the walls, she went to the bookcase and took down the tin box from the highest shelf. She did this every visit, had checked it every year since she'd first noticed it as a girl of 10. Inside were 4 letters from Lord Chichester to her mum, all businesslike in manner, arranging for Sarah's expenses and care, as long as they promised to stay away. Sarah had shown her mother the letters and been met with vitriol. as if her mother had been waiting for the moment of truth. She raged about being forced out by the Countess, banished with an ungrateful child to care for. From then on, every misstep Sarah made had been an excuse to berate her as the cause of her mother's downfall. Never mind the Earl of Chichester's part in the matter. Her mother had loved running Stanmer House. Her militaristic need for order made her good at her job, and Sarah was certain she'd worshipped Lord Chichester with the devotion of a lapdog. In return, she'd been dismissed. How awful it would have been for her to relinquish the set of household keys, an emblem of her power over nearly every other servant, from where they had hung on her ever-expanding waist. Her mother had retreated, and expected her daughter to do better. But in spite of her mother's determination, Sarah had failed as an apprentice and become a lowly maid. Her mother had never forgiven her, nor asked why the sudden change occurred. Not that Sarah would ever tell her. Still, how horrible it must have been for her mother to be forced out of a familiar role and setting, hidden away after years of servitude. Sarah bristled against the injustice, as her own position at the Langham was similarly precarious, dependent on the tyrannical whims of Mr. Birmingham, no matter how competent her administration. Her short meeting with Mr. Camden, while curious, had reminded her that she was, in fact, good at her job. When she'd first been promoted, the challenge of balancing the many duties of head housekeeper had exhilarated her. She maneuvered her troops like a general at war, ensuring the precision and consistency of service that made the Langham one of the top hotels in London. But it was never enough for Mr. Birmingham, and the job had recently begun to fray her nerves. She ran herself ragged all day, before flopping into bed exhausted, but unable to sleep because of the many details to be dealt with first thing in the morning. Cajole the irritable head laundress into putting less bleach in the sheets, determine which maid had stolen a tortoiseshell comb from room 322. She put the letters away and wandered out the back of the cottage. The thick stems of the fleur-de-lis lay across the pathway like fallen sentries. The orange evening sky lit the water in the pond with a flame of color, as if both water and air were burning. She was 30 years old, too old to change, to go to a completely different continent and start over. Yet, what she'd read about America in the papers intrigued her. No worrying about using the proper titles. Everyone was called a Mrs., Mr., or Miss. The American guests she'd met, like Mr. Camden, tended to be far less demanding than the English ones. As it stood, she could stay at the Langham for another 30 years, then retire to this cottage and take up where her mother had left off. Tea by the fire, sherry by the fire, before beginning all over again the next day. Or she could try something new.
Chapter 3. New York City, September 1985. Bailey sank into a stiff, mid-century chair in the waiting room of the offices of Crespo and O'Reilly, happy to be out of the stifling New York City heat. She took a tissue out of her handbag and dabbed at her cheeks and forehead. The unfortunate perm that Tristan O'Reilly had insisted she have 6 months ago had begun to grow out, but after the boiling subway ride, she probably looked like a disheveled poodle. Not the look she was going for when she started out this morning. Tristan, who cared only for beautiful things, wasn't going to be pleased.
"He'll see you now."
The receptionist wasn't familiar, but then again, Tristan went through them every 3 months, so he was right on schedule. 3 months she'd been away. It felt more like 3 years. An itchiness spread up her spine to her neck, and she took a deep breath. The receptionist stood.
"This way, please."
Bailey followed obediently, passing her old office. The woman behind the desk glanced up and gave Bailey a startled smile before snapping her head back to the fabric samples in front of her. Wanda, of all people. Wanda, who couldn't tell the difference between Shantung and Dupeony. Bailey could outshine her with a client any day. She was shown into the corner office.
There you are, my girl.
Tristan rose and did some kind of balletic shuffle on his way to embrace Bailey. He'd trained with American Ballet Theater before joining interior design superstar Diego Crespo as an assistant, then worked his way up to boyfriend and business partner. Diego spent most of his time in East Hampton these days, while Tristan helmed the organization. They'd brought on Bailey right out of Parsons School of Design, and Tristan had been her main confidant and party partner, until everything had tipped over the edge. She sank into his hug.
Tristan, I missed you so much.
I bet you did, baby. How are you doing?
He held her at arm's length, and she blinked under his penetrating stare. I'm hanging in there? A second wave of sweat, from nerves, not humidity, broke over her.
Your hair?
He didn't bother finishing the sentence. I know, it's a mess. Tristan gestured to the chair and sat on the corner of his desk. He wasn't a handsome man, at least not as handsome as the swarthy Diego, but he knew enough to dress his lithe body with the perfect colors and cut. Today, he wore an azure linen blazer that set off the blue of his eyes. His blonde hair, while thinning, was pomaded into place like a schoolboy's, impeccably put together, as always.
Tell me, how was Silver Hill?
Bailey shrugged.
It was rehab. Lots of talking, lots of people bitching about their sad lives. You're feeling better?
Much better. She didn't mention how most of the time she was dying for a drink, and that once 5 o'clock hit, she made herself hole up in the East Village studio apartment of her roommate from Silver Hill, where she was temporarily crashing until the girl got sprung. Bailey would pull down the Murphy bed and lie with a pillow over her head to block out the sirens and shouting, hoping it would do the same for her cravings.
Did you see any celebrities? I heard that Liza Minnelli checked herself in. Did you meet her?
Bailey hadn't drunk the Kool-Aid of the counselors there, all that touchy-feely stuff. But the stories she'd heard had been brutal, and she respected the idea that it was all anonymous. That some dirt ought not to be dished. Of course, there was no explaining that to Tristan, who lived on gossip. No, didn't see her. She leaned forward. But I wanted to thank you and Diego. For everything. I know you guys probably saved my life. Tristan waved at her and walked to the chair behind his desk. He paused a moment, dramatically, before sitting down and squaring his shoulders.
It was the right thing to do. You're just going to have to watch yourself going forward. Only 2 glasses of champagne at Palladium, then I'm cutting you off.
No, Tristan, no more champagne. She hoped he was joking. I can't drink anymore. Or do anything else.
Of course you can't.
She was eager to get that part of the conversation over with. The one that shamed her to the core. How was business?
Excellent. We just got the townhouse on East 77th Street. The one that Rebecca Meyer bought in the spring.
He didn't wait for her to respond.
The renovation started a couple of weeks ago, and she's insisting on importing all the antiques from Morocco and London, if you can believe it. And get this. Last week, Lily Beth Latwick flew me by helicopter to her place in East Hampton because her maid had rearranged the throw pillows on the sectional, and she couldn't remember which way they should go.
He snapped his fingers.
Chopper, baby!
Wow, that's insane.
We also landed the Sanford's Beach House. Massive place. All zen aesthetic and ferns. I have Wanda on that one. I figure she can't go wrong when everything will be shades of white. White carpet, white sofas.
You better stay on top of her. If anyone could choose clashing shades of eggshell, it would be her.
Good point.
He smiled, offering a view of gleaming teeth like a row of chiclets.
In fact, that was why I wanted to stop by today. The teeth disappeared. I know I blew out of here in a spectacular fashion, but I'd like to make it up to you and Diego. For everything you've done for me these past few months, I could work with Wanda, act as a go-between with the Sanfords. You know, her people skills leave a lot to be desired. Tristan sighed.
I know, darling. We would love to have you back.
Thank God. One problem solved.
But the news got around fast. Of course, how could it not? You were screaming at Mrs. Ashfield Simmons in the middle of the Oak Room, telling her that her daughter's apartment was a nightmare. A blend of medieval bullshit and white trash, I believe you said.
Bailey cringed. She didn't remember any of it. She knew, of course, that she'd made a fool of herself and the company. I'll call her and apologize. I'll write a letter to her daughter, too. I'll make it all good.
It's already been taken care of. The important thing is you're okay.
I'm sober now, so I'll probably be twice as productive. I promise you'll get a real bang for your buck.
God, she sounded like a used car salesman.
I'll obviously take a pay cut. I understand that would have to be a precondition. If he didn't take her back, she didn't know where she'd turn. No other interior design firm would touch her now, not to mention that she only had another week left to crash in the East Village before her Silver Hill roommate returned to claim it. Before Bailey's epic breakdown, she'd shacked up with a boyfriend named Rocco, who now that she had better clarity of mind, she could see was really a drug dealer, not a Basquiat-esque artist. So that option was out. As was slinking home so her father could point out that he had been right all along, that she should never have come to New York in the first place. Look, Tristan, I messed up. But you know I can run rings around anyone else here. When it comes to interacting with the clients, with the contractors, you name it. My eye is the best. You've said that yourself so many times. Even when I was strung out, I was great.
Let me have one more chance.
Tristan peered sideways at her through slitted eyelids. Not good.
Listen, Bailey. You put us through hell. We covered for you this past year. You have no idea how much we covered for you. Because we love you. And because, yes, you were good. You were the best. And you could have done amazing things here. We all party. We all have a good time. But you took it too far.
The harshness of his words stung. Okay. Wow. She looked down at the floor, hating the lucidity of sobriety more than ever. I didn't realize how bad it was.
Bad is an understatement. I love you, but I'm dropping you.
Dropping her? Like she was contagious. You're being really harsh about this. If you don't mind me saying it, you're being an asshole. She said it with a slight smile on her face, in the same way they used to banter back and forth.
Bad idea. You disappointed me then, and you're disappointing me now. Do you actually have the nerve to waltz in here and practically demand to be hired back?
Tristan twitched his shoulders before tugging on the cuff of each sleeve, a familiar tick that meant the meeting was over.
I love you, and I always will, and that's why we paid for you to go to Silver Hill, which, by the way, is fucking expensive. So don't expect any more from us, okay? You wouldn't fit in here anymore.
She sat for a moment, too stunned to move.
I'm sorry, Bailey. But we're done here. You're done here.
Bailey stood outside on the sweltering sidewalk, trying not to think about how good a Chardonnay would taste right now. The touch of the glass on her lips, the intense acidity,
followed by the velvet sensation that all was right in the world. Back when she drank, she could live in the moment. High on weed or on coke, the past and the future ceased to exist. While ensconced in the lush, landscaped grounds of Silver Hill, she was able to see that way of thinking wasn't helpful, and she had talked about her past openly, more than she had with anyone. But here in the city, no one cared. If she turned right and headed down the side street, she was sure to come upon one of the dozen Irish pubs that lined the blocks of Midtown, places where office workers could escape from the monotony of their lives. The room where they'd had group at Silver Hill was covered in mottos from the program. One day at a time, and no matter where you go, there you are. Well, here she was. A drippy, pathetic mess, desperate for a drink in a dive bar. She checked her watch. There was no time for liquid distractions. She was due to meet Melinda at Café Luxembourg in the West 70s in a half hour. That was truly her last chance. The train would be a steamy cauldron of humanity this time of day. The windows slanted open, like the heat of the tunnels wasn't just as unbearable as the fiery furnace of the subway car. She couldn't face it. Instead, she headed north on foot, cutting into Central Park at 7th Avenue. Before her mother's death, Bailey and her parents would venture into the city a couple times a year from their house in New Jersey, usually to see a Broadway musical where dancers executed fast, furious combinations that took Bailey's breath away, while her father, Jack, squirmed in the too small seat next to her. But Bailey and her mother always buzzed with excitement the morning before, choosing their dresses with care, as if they might get discovered during their big day out. Once, in Manhattan, her mother would point out her old haunts, like the building where she attended some posh secretarial school for 3 months before getting married, and the Horn and Hard Art Automat, where she and Jack met. During one excursion, having arrived 2 hours before curtain, Bailey had suggested they visit the boat pond in the park. She'd brought along a magazine with a photo of a gondola passing under an arched bridge and thrust it between the front seats of their Volkswagen Beetle.
"It's so pretty."
"No one goes in the park," Jack warned. "It's full of gang members, all dust and graffiti because the city ran out of money to take care of it. It's a ruin, like the rest of Manhattan."
Her mother studied the magazine. "What if we walk along Central Park West? We could stop by the Dakota and drop in on your relatives."
"For God's sake, Peggy. No one drops in like that in the city. And they're not my relatives, remember?"
The conversation came to a halt as Jack slammed on the brakes, narrowly missing a bicycle messenger. They'd eaten soggy fries and overcooked burgers in a diner to kill the time instead. Bailey didn't see the city as a ruin. She saw important people going to important places. She'd wanted to be one of them. For a while, she had been. But now, her fall from grace was complete. As Bailey got deeper into the park and away from the grid of streets, the air became noticeably cooler. A light wind blew in from the west. Thunderstorms were predicted for the afternoon, and the rhythmic whispering of the leaves helped slow the beat of her heart and her desire for a drink. She took a deep breath. The park was a mess still, that was true, but a private group had taken over the maintenance, and the place was getting spruced up. The trash situation seemed better than ever, no more overflowing bins with rats leaping out of them. Progress. An ugly chain-link fence lined the north side of the 72nd Street Park entrance. Bailey was breathing hard from the walk and the heat, and she stopped for a moment, clawing the metal with her fingers and pressing her face into the diamond pattern like a child. The area, recently dubbed Strawberry Fields in John Lennon's memory, was due to open to the public next month. 5 years since he'd been gunned down. Every one of her generation remembered where they were when they found out, as if it had just happened yesterday. A shout from one of the workers brought her out of her thoughts. A couple of the guys at the base of the excavator stared down at something in the dirt, then called to what seemed to be a supervisor, who ambled over, coffee cup in his hand. The supervisor motioned for the excavator driver to cut his engine and wiped his forehead with a red bandana. They all stood in a circle, necks craned downward, as if in prayer. Bailey moved on. The Dakota loomed large as she waited for the light to change. The sides were gray, coated with a century of soot, but it still stood out from its neighbors. No subtle Art Deco motifs here. This was pure decadence. Gables, windows of all shapes and sizes. A filthy, aging dowager of a building. Bailey counted up 4 stories and located Melinda's apartment. When she was a child, Bailey and her parents had visited Melinda, her twin brother Manville, and their mother once a year, usually around the holidays. The twins' mother, Sophia, was a throwback to the old days, encrusted with jewels, even at breakfast, her manner cold and officious. The early family gatherings had always been awkward affairs, the tension between Bailey's dad and her aunt palpable. The economic divide, an enormous chasm. Once, Melinda had insisted Bailey stay for an overnight visit. They'd raided the kitchen in the still hours of the early morning, cramming Lucky Charms into their mouths straight from the box, while Melinda whispered the gory details of the murder of her great-grandfather, the architect, Theodore Camden, in that very apartment. They crept into the dark library, and Melinda pointed to the far corner near the window.
"He was killed by some woman who used to work in the building," Melinda whispered. "She stabbed him, and he bled to death on this very spot, begging for mercy. She was crazy, they say, cut off his finger and kept it as a souvenir. Look closer. You can see the blood."
Bailey leaned forward, squinting, to make out a dark pattern on the floor. Melinda suddenly tweaked her on either side of her waist, making her jump and scream, and they ran back to the safety of Melinda's canopied bed, crying and laughing at the same time. The girls had gotten closer once Bailey moved to the city for college, the two of them gradually increasing the dosage and frequency of banned substances in their systems. Manville, meanwhile, graduated from Yale and headed to the Deep South to do a dissertation on self-taught artists, only returning a few times, including when Sophia died 7 years ago. Melinda had a brashness that Bailey envied, and together they measured their lives by the number of parties attended. But every so often, usually as Bailey's body expelled the toxins ingested the night before through cold sweats and vomit, she recognized that her mother, had she still been alive, would have been dismayed and worried. Peggy would have taken Bailey aside and given her a thoughtful lecture on her extended absence from their New Jersey home and the sallow, unhealthy tone of her skin. She would have held her accountable. Jack wasn't up to the task. He'd retreated into his shell as soon as they put Bailey's mother in the ground. In rehab, the counselors had asked her lots of questions about her mother's death, suggesting that Bailey process it. She'd fought back, insisting that being left alone at 18 had toughened her up. There was no need to process anything. The facts were the facts. Drunk driver plus Garden State Parkway equaled Bailey packing up her things and starting freshman year at Parsons with hardly a peep from her dad. She'd kept busy with classes and socializing and exploring every dark crack of the city, until Tristan hired her and pulled her into the fabulous world of Crespo and O'Reilly. Café Luxembourg was practically empty this time of day, the waiters standing in pairs chatting in order to fill the empty hours between the lunch and dinner crowds. Melinda wasn't there yet, so Bailey took a booth seat where she had a good view of the door. It wasn't long until Melinda swept in,
wearing a jumpsuit with enormous shoulder pads, her blonde hair in perfect swirls down her back, as if she walked in a bubble that protected her from the humidity that plagued the common man. She threw the Barney's bag she was carrying on the floor and held out her arms.
Cousin!
Melinda, her last hope.
Chapter 4, London, September 1884. Mr. Birmingham gave a low growl when Sarah gave her notice.
You think you'll find something better over there, do you?
He asked. She didn't answer, and instead made suggestions for a trouble-free transition, and offered to interview her successor. The staff threw a small party on her last day, but it had a desultory air. She packed up her bedsit, and that was that. On to a new continent. During the 8-day journey from Liverpool to New York City, Sarah spent as much time up on the ship deck as possible to avoid the stench of seasickness from her cabin mates below. To her surprise, the incessant rolling of the ship didn't bother her at all, and she found the week off to be something of a delight. She read in peace in one of the deck chairs, with no schedule and no Mr. Birmingham to tell her what to do or when to do it. It was all she could do not to stow away on board and enjoy another week instead of disembarking. From her favorite spot on deck, she could see over to the first-class passengers, barricaded by a gate, as they wandered the decks in their gowns and were fussed over by the waitstaff. Some of the sharply dressed servers made their rounds with goblets of lemonade on gleaming silver trays. Others brought sugar cookies still fragrant from the oven that made Sarah's mouth water. But she didn't mind the meals in the second-class dining room, and every morning carried a weak broth and tea to the women in her cabin, who were unable to move from their beds. A moan was the most she could hope for in response to her bright greeting. On the last day of the voyage, a gray drizzle fell as the ship made its way into New York Harbor. The city was made up of a mishmash of buildings crowded together like a mouse with too many teeth. She imagined the ones on the edge of the waterfront being pushed into the sea as more and more popped up to fill any crevices. One dark church spire erupted from the rooftops, and she overheard another passenger say it was Trinity Church. She'd be sure to visit, thinking it might be a calm place where she could gather her thoughts during an afternoon off. The passengers in steerage had to wait until they reached Castle Garden to be processed, but with her second-class ticket, Sarah was provided the dignity of an onboard inspection and interview. The confusion on the docks made her anxious once she stepped off the ship. The smell of rotting fish and fried oysters overwhelmed, and everyone seemed to be shouting at the top of their lungs. Newspaper boys, street urchins, and vendors called out in abrasive accents, the vowels all wrong and flat. Everyone seemed to know where they were going, and were intent on getting there in the fastest way possible, stepping into the middle of the street even though a wagon was bearing down, and narrowly missing being hit. London was a pastoral village compared to this. Through the riot of noise, she heard her name. A driver in a fine black carriage stood up, yelling above the din. She waved back and let him help her climb inside, admiring the burgundy velvet interior. She eyed the driver through the rear window to ensure her trunk was securely fastened to the rear, and then settled in. They drove through town and kept on going, until vacant land and fields outnumbered the buildings. She knocked on the roof to get his attention. He twisted his thick torso around to see her.
Yes, ma'am.
Are we going to the Dakota? The new apartment house?
We are indeed.
But it appears we've left the city.
This is all New York City, ma'am. You can see the markers for the streets.
Indeed. Even if the streets were no longer paved with granite, they remained regularly spaced apart. But there's nothing here. Around her was treeless farmland and cattle grazing in muddy fields. It was as if the landscape had been flattened by an enormous gust of wind, and only now was coming back to life with tired shanties and sad barns. This was New York? They carried on. Outside, a pretty young girl walked down the street, followed by a gang of boys who tossed pebbles at her. The girl whirled around and ran at them, and they scattered into the street. When Sarah was younger, her face had garnered more attention than she would have liked. But now her features were less of a liability. No one mistook her for an innocent maid, and her aquiline nose and raised eyebrow worked in her favor as a tool to stare down unruly sorts, whether a shifty janitor or a haughty guest. New York wasn't going to frighten her. Yet as the carriage swayed up the wide avenue with an empty park on one side and a wasteland on the other, her heart sank. In London, you could wander the squares and see loveliness. You just had to know where to look. Nothing was lovely here. She shifted to the other side of the carriage and stuck her head out the window. An enormous building, the color of butter, seemed to have been plopped down on the flat landscape by a giant, like something you'd find in a German fairy tale. She counted 9 stories, with windows that a man could stand in and not reach the top pane, and a complicated gabled roof lacking any consistent pattern.
Is that it?
Sure is. They've been working on it for years.
The driver turned his head and shouted back at her.
Built by a fool named Clark.
Why is Clark a fool?
It's a monstrosity in the middle of nowhere. No good families would dream of living here, I tell you. Can only imagine what sort will end up inside. Lucky Devil died before he could see it finished.
She'd pictured a handsome building like the Langham, smack in the middle of the city, surrounded by shops and parks, where broughams with well-matched pairs of horses pulled up to discharge their passengers. But this place was dismal, the streets still unpaved. She should have asked more questions about the owners, the location. If the driver were correct, the clientele would be ignorant of the niceties, fine linens, good manners, a certain distance from the staff that made the role of housekeeper manageable. The man pulled into an arch cut through the middle of the building. When she stepped out, the ground seemed to shift underneath her. She'd been told by one of the ship's porters that it might take a few days for her sea legs to let her be. A wiry old man approached, speaking out of the side of his mouth.
Are you Mrs. Smythe?
She nodded.
Been expecting you. I'm Fitzroy, the head porter. Why don't you wait inside while I arrange for your belongings?
He gestured to the right, where a steep set of stairs led to a small reception room. 2 large windows let in ample light, and the walls were covered in handsome wood paneling that matched the built-in desk and countertop. A switchboard took up most of the back wall. The porter joined her, rubbing his hands together. The side of his face drooped, as if it was falling off his skull. But his eyes, including the one that turned down at the edge, were a warm brown. He pointed at the switchboard.
Got all the latest gadgets here, you'll find. We have private wires going to the fire station, the stables, the telegraph messenger office, and the forest. 4,000 electric lights, even.
Very modern.
How was your journey? You came from abroad?
Yes, England.
Right. The building agent, Mr. Douglas, said to show you around.
He led her into the courtyard, currently in use by the craftsmen, and they wove around toolboxes and sawhorses supporting large pieces of wood. She looked up once, and the dizziness returned. The courtyard felt too small for the massive building around it, like the walls were about to cave in. Mr. Fitzroy touched her lightly on the elbow to steady her. He pointed up.
That's where you'll be, on the top floor. Lovely view. Once the elevators are working, you won't have to trudge up the stairs. First of their kind in a residential building in New York City, I'll have you know.
We had several lifts in the London hotel where I worked previously. His enthusiasm remained undamped.
I'll show you ours tomorrow if you like. An amazing piece of machinery. Runs on water. All hydraulics.
He must be balmy. A lift run by water. But she was too tired to inquire further. Exhaustion swept over her. This Bavarian behemoth out in the